This is not a blessing, it is a curse. The oil is a curse. I'm sorry, we're born with it under our feet.
Today has been a day where very, very few people went out. The battle around the airport last night has been extremely heavy and loud.
I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, April 4th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The strongest evidence to date that Saddam Hussein has survived the initial attack on Iraq. The Red Cross reports over 100 civilian casualties a day being treated at a hospital in Baghdad. And the words of the drum major for peace, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., still ring true on this 35th anniversary of his death. These stories and more on tonight's Peace Watch, but first, these news headlines.
With the headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Daniel Costello.
And I'm Janaki Lafis. The foreign ministers of France, Russia, and Germany reiterated today their demands that the United Nations take the lead in post-war Iraq. The German foreign minister said only the United Nations can legitimize this work. The ministers did not respond to Secretary of State Colin Powell's remarks yesterday that Americans should have the leading role in post-war Iraq. Reuters reports that U.S. troops have found thousands of boxes containing vials of unidentified liquid and powder, as well as manuals on chemical warfare, at two sites near Baghdad. The Hindu reports today that India is giving $20 million in humanitarian aid to Iraq in response to the United Nations' urgent request for help.
A senior United Nations official says a U.S.-run administration in Iraq won't have authority over its oil wealth. Susan Wood reports from the U.N.
The head of the U.N. Development Program, Mark Malik Brown, says the Bush administration will have to seek authorization from the Security Council before using Iraqi oil exports to finance reconstruction or awarding major contracts to U.S. corporations. The Houston Chronicle reported on Thursday that a retired Shell Oil chief executive has been asked by the Defense Department to oversee post-war Iraqi oil production. The executive, Philip Carroll, said he thought U.S. oil companies should get 10 to 20-year concessions as a reward for modernizing Iraq's crippled oil industry. But UNDP's Malik Brown says it would be illegal under the Geneva Conventions for the U.S. as an occupying power to enter into long-term legal commitments. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Presidential hopeful John Kerry was criticized by the GOP for calling for a regime change in the United States. For more on the story in Washington, here's James Cullum.
John Kerry, Democratic senator and potential 2004 presidential candidate, has angered Republicans by saying that regime change should extend to the ousting of President Bush and his administration. Kerry broke his silence about the conduct of the president since the March 19th launch of operations against Iraq, saying to a New Hampshire audience that, quote, it will take a new president, unquote, to repair the lost trust between the U.S. and other countries. Republicans say that this statement is inappropriate and ill-timed. However, Kerry spokesman Robert Gibbs defends the senator and says that as a legitimate candidate, Kerry must voice confidence in his ability to defeat the president in the upcoming election.
Senator Kerry is obviously a candidate for president, and the point of our campaign is to change the administration of this government. That's what he meant. To become president, he has to change the president.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
A Southern African task team will investigate Zimbabwe's political crisis next week, which has been characterized by wide-scale intimidation of the opposition. Naeem Jina reports from Johannesburg.
Following a meeting yesterday of the Southern African Development Community, a task force is due to visit Zimbabwe next week to investigate the country's political crisis, which has seen a massive crackdown of the opposition by President Robert Mugabe over the past 2 weeks. Earlier, Zimbabwe's Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, had urged the meeting to condemn the arrest and alleged torture of its members. These followed a two-day strike and massive protests last month. Hundreds of opposition members were arrested. The MDC says 500 of its members were arrested, 250 hospitalized, and scores tortured. MDC leader Morgan Tsvangirai, who faces charges of plotting to assassinate Mugabe, warned the SADC that Zimbabwe faces a civil war which could destabilize the entire region. The task force will begin its work next week by inviting all stakeholders to the Zimbabwe crisis to express their positions and grievances. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naeem Jina in Johannesburg.
This weekend, people from over 12 southern states are gathering to confront dramatic cutbacks in resources devoted to health, education, housing, and welfare. These resources are directed into a growing prison system and into the military. Renee Feltz has more.
Critical Resistance South kicked off today against a giant wall of prisoner portraits drawn by children at a New Orleans elementary school. Conference coordinator Melissa Birch.
At the start of the news conference, we said we'd like to start this news conference by asking a question of our country. And then a huge green and white banner unfurled from the third floor of the school that said, "Why are so many people we love behind bars?"
At the press conference, organizers released a report on the Southern prison crisis that indicates if Louisiana and Mississippi were countries, they would have the highest incarceration rates in the world. Several other southern states have incarceration rates higher than the national or regional average. I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
From Community Radio KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jonicky Lafice.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. References to a downed U.S. helicopter in Saddam Hussein's video message today suggest it was made after the strike aimed at killing him. A U.S. intelligence official said the message provided some of the strongest evidence yet that the Iraqi president survived the attack. The official stopped short of saying the video message, which was broadcast on Iraqi television today, provided conclusive proof he was still alive and in command of the Iraqi regime. With the electricity out for over a day now and all telephone lines down in Baghdad due to U.S. bombing of the Iraqi communications facility earlier this week, reports on the humanitarian situation in Iraq's largest city are getting harder and harder to come by. Earlier today, Peace Watch was able to reach International Committee of the Red Cross spokesman Roland Huguenin Benjamin, who's currently in Baghdad. Speaking to us on his satellite telephone, Benjamin said that casualties are continuing to rise in the constant bombing is clearly taking a toll on the residents of Baghdad.
Today has been a day where very, very few people went out. The battle around the airport last night has been extremely heavy and loud. It was practically impossible to get any sleep anyway all through the night for the sound of the bombardment that was going on. And in the morning there were very, very few people out in the street. First, because it is Friday and this is a day of rest in an Islamic country. And second, because as you know, all shops have been closed for a long time, except for just a few grocers. And the night had been so heavy that I suppose everybody was just trying to stay safe at home or catch up on sleep or whatever, but there was definitely very little movement. I took the chance of going to the major hospital today to find out what it had been like after a night of fighting. And they had taken in a much higher number of casualties than in any of the previous days since that war started. We had an average of 100 casualties per night or per day in the hospital so far in Baghdad City. Today it was over 300.
Which hospital was that?
Yarmouk is the largest one that has taken the highest number, and because there were just too many patients for one hospital to cope with, the sent some over to other hospitals in town.
Are the hospitals filled with civilian casualties or military casualties or a combination of both?
Well, these hospitals, until now, they were catering only for civilians. But as of last night, probably because there was a high number of military casualties near the airport, they also took in some of them. That was the first time we noticed that there was a high number of military people amongst the wounded that were treated at that particular hospital. There was also a higher percentage of serious injuries, which is quite logical and to be expected, considering that these are people who have been in fighting themselves. I mean, they're not people who have been hit indirectly by shrapnels like it happens to civilians. When people are in fighting, of course, they do get hurt.
When we spoke to you earlier this week, you described a very graphic scene of civilian injuries from a very, what you consider to have been a direct hit. Have you witnessed any additional instances like that or victims?
No, that very bad scene we saw in the south of Baghdad in Hilla the other day mercifully has not been repeated so far, at least not to our knowledge. Of course, we still do not know what has been going on in cities like Najaf and Karbala further south. It has been impossible to travel there because of the front and the combats going on, and also because one of the major bridges on the road leading down south has been bombed out, and now the traffic is interrupted.
We understand that the lights have been out in Baghdad for almost 24 hours. Do you have access to a backup generator? How are you able to function without
Our office has a backup generator. Otherwise, it would make life totally impossible. We really depend on our computers and satellite phones and all these things. So we do have a backup generator, but the city was absolutely pitch dark. It was very impressive. You know, last night was a moonless night, and then the fact that there were absolutely no lights all around, driving back home at the end of my day, it must have been like even 11 at night, I could hardly see the road, you know, just saw a little bit of light in front of my car, but I saw absolutely nothing around. It was pitch dark. I've seldom experienced that in the heart of a city, where you always expect to see at least some little twinkle of light and, you know, from windows or whatever, but there was absolutely nothing yesterday. It was very, very dark.
Your organization is there, obviously, as a humanitarian aid group. What kind of documentation of civilian casualties do you have any figures at this point as to how many innocent civilian lives have been lost so far?
We have some figures for wounded. We had like 100 on average per day in Baghdad until now. As of today, it's much more, as I told you. For Basra, we found out after 1 week when our team could enter Basra that there had been a few hundred. There are three major hospitals that had either 250 or 350 casualties each. And as far as fatalities are involved, we really have no way of knowing, because fatalities are always transported to the Forensic Medicine Institute to establish certificates necessary for the burial. And, of course, since we are not involved in any of these procedures, we have no way of knowing the exact figure or no way of cross-checking the exact figure.
Roland Huguenin Benjamin is a spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. As several mainstream media sources continue to report news and information that makes you wonder whether their reporters are embedded or embed, some would say, with the U.S. military, Pacifica Radio was privileged to have uncensored news reports from KPFK's Jerry Quickly. Quickly recently returned from Iraq after being deported by Iraqi authorities one day after bombs began dropping. He was recently interviewed by Pacifica host Michael Slate.
I got to visit one of the hospitals and a couple of different clinics, and also one of the treatment plants as well, one of the water treatment plants, which is also one of the human shield sites. The water treatment, status of water in Baghdad has improved substantially in the last couple of years, but that being said, that's really saying very, very little. It's still very spotty and uneven in terms of its cleanliness. You're very likely to get sick if you drink it, most particularly if you're not if your system is not fully rooted in, you know, in the local bacteria, so to speak. You know that every place around the world has, and the sites like the human shields are at, like, including the water treatment center. The water treatment center, the Taji food silo, the Eldora electrical plant, the Dora oil refinery, the South Baghdad power plant, these are all places that were destroyed within 24 hours, 36 hours in one or two cases of the commencement of the last Gulf War. And that's one of the reasons why the shields were staying at these sites. There were some 60 sites around the country that they were given their choice of staying at. And I really think in many ways the human shields represent the best of humanity. They are very much risking their lives to protect the lives of the Iraqi people. And it's only been within the last 14 hours that power has been lost in Baghdad. And the only reason I believe that these central places like the water treatment plant and the oil refinery and the power stations, and that, you know, these are all interrelated sites. You know, they, if you don't have oil to run the electrical plant, you cannot run the water treatment center. If you don't have power from the electrical plant, of course, you can't sustain the hospitals, et cetera. So these are all kind of critical components of the Iraqi infrastructure that were all destroyed within hours of the last Gulf War, that were all, with the exception of Taji, they were all left up and running and largely unmolested by the U.S. military until very, very recently. And I think that the only reason that happened is because of the shields. And in terms of the hospitals there and the clinics, you know, the hospitals are little more than, you know, places you go to for advice and emotional support. There are almost no there's no significant medication or drugs or antibiotics available, even pain medicine. You have children with grossly distended abdomens from impacted bowels and other things that are very easily treated and very easily solvable but aren't there. And you you see a number of people and children that are very likely to expire within a short period. You know, you go one day and they're there, and the next day their beds are empty, or there's someone else in the bed, and it's the situation is horribly acute for the children of Iraq. The sanctions have had a devastating impact on the lives of the Iraqi people, and of course, in when you talk about, you know, the economic suffering, you know, of course, most dramatically affects the children and the poor, and that was certainly the case in Iraq. And that combined with the pressure of the pending and then the actual war that was taking place, you know, when I was there, was the effects were very dramatic on the people. There met this one young mother at the Al Mansour Children's Hospital, she had a 2-year-old at home, and her 6-year-old was sick in the hospital. And her husband was serving in an army unit in the south, so she was left to take care of the children herself. Most of her family was also in the south. But in any event, you know, as the war was coming up, it left her with a very, very difficult and a very, 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 very difficult space, trying to decide, she can't bring the younger child to the hospital, and she can't not be there for the older child. So she's really just, you know, running back and forth, you know, running herself ragged. But then it's not even just about running back and forth and running yourself ragged. What happens when the war starts? And, you know, which child are you going to pick, you know? And that was common. That wasn't a circumstance that was limited to a single woman. That was a common scenario in many Iraqi families were facing. And the hospitals themselves are grossly substandard. They're little more than way stations, you know, that provide aspirin and emotional support. The children in the Iraqi hospitals, it's hard to relate with words in a sense, because I've never come in contact with that level of human suffering before, and while I certainly knew before I got there that the situation would be very, very difficult, it's one thing to kind of know that and be aware of it on an intellectual level, and it's quite another thing. It's quite another thing to watch how much suffering the children go through throughout the countryside. You know, throughout the entire country, all the cities and the little villages I went to, all these places, People were fiercely determined to fight against the Americans. I mean, there's a reason that, you know, even with all this massive artillery, massive air power, you know, all this technology, all these weapons, kind of limitless supplies and support, seemingly limitless, that they still had to kind of shut down the war for a few days, shut down their forward progress for a few days, and retrench because they're having the supply lines harassed. They were, of course, if people got cut off, that if the soldiers got cut off, that would be more difficult. There's a reason that the British soldiers are just now beginning to enter Basra 2 weeks into the fight, and they're claiming now they own a piece of Basra when in fact they're still across the river from the main section of the city, because the only way they can enter these areas is by inflicting tremendously high numbers of casualties on the civilian population. And the administration further takes a position that basically unless the Iraqi soldiers come out into a field and neatly keep themselves planted there out in the open to be murdered by bombs, anything else, any act of defense is an act of terrorism and a war crime. It's wildly out of sync with, all the administration's claims that I have heard are wildly out of sync with the statements from the Iraqi people. Many of the statements of the Iraqi people, there was one guy in particular in Nasiriyah who he's a Shia Muslim and he really disliked Saddam and went and explained to me in great detail all the reasons he disliked Saddam. He loathed Saddam. And just described how many people were killed during the last Gulf War and blah, 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 blah. He didn't have a lot of love for the first Bush either because of Bush's abandonment of the Shia people when they rose up against Saddam. But after he got through this long anti-Saddam take, I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is the first, you know, Iraqi I've met, you know, in country who's, you know, firmly anti-Saddam. Deeply so, and, you know, you couldn't divest him of his anti-Saddam sentiment. And as he got through explaining the story, he then said, I will fight with my last breath for Saddam's hell rather than live with America's heaven. And I said, well, wow, why do you feel that way? Why would you do that? And he said, because this is not the land for America, and we're not here to service America. We are free people. We are allowed to choose our own destiny. And if we must be stuck with Saddam now, we're stuck. And, you know, he was very clear about the fact that while he was very, very unhappy with Saddam, he was even more angry with the possibility that America was going to come and make war and impose their will. There'll never be a president there who will go unharassed, in my estimation, having spoken to the people there. And there'll never be an American soldier that's safe in Iraq. They're going to be harassed and shot and killed, much like the British troops in Belfast, for the duration of their stay. It's truly horrific. It's going to be bloody for American soldiers and catastrophic for the people of Iraq. It's very unfortunate. A student there that I met at Baghdad University said that, you know, he had tears in his eyes and was very apologetic in a sense. You know, he said, I'm sorry, Jerry. This is not right. I'm very, very sorry. It's not our fault. It's not our fault that we were born with oil under our feet. This is not a blessing. It is a curse. The oil is a curse. I'm sorry we're born with it under our feet.
KPFK's Jerry Quickly speaking to Michael Slate about his recent trip to Iraq. That interview was produced by Christine Blasdale and edited by Fidel Rodriguez. This week, Israel's National Infrastructures Minister Joseph Peretzky requested an assessment of the condition of an old oil pipeline. The pipeline runs from Mosul, northern Iraq, to Haifa, Israel. And Peretzky has his eye on renewing its operation if Saddam Hussein is toppled and a government friendly to Israel is installed in Baghdad. Peretzky told Israel's Haaretz newspaper that resurrecting the pipeline to Haifa could save Israel the high cost of shipping oil from Russia. He said he's certain that the Americans would respond favorably to the idea since the pipeline would bring Iraqi oil directly to the Mediterranean. Right now, there's only one legal pipeline for northern Iraq oil with a terminus in Yarmouk on Turkey's Mediterranean coast. And as Aaron Glantz reports from the pipeline's control center, exports of Iraqi oil have been suspended because of the war.
United Nations officials try to kill time fixing minor problems on their computer. There's not much happening at the western terminus of Iraq's Mosul-Kirkuk oil pipeline these days. The oil is still flowing out of Iraq and into the 130,000 cubic meter tanks here. But since George Bush launched his war on Iraq, no American oil tankers have docked to pick up the oil. Hans Schunkler heads up the UN Oil for Food program at the terminal.
For the moment, what we are doing here, it's not really much, because nothing is going out. The ships which have been here have been cancelled, and they've been gone. So that was the end of it.
For the last 7 years, oil flow at the Umatilla terminal has been governed by the United Nations Oil for Food program. Under the terms of the program, Iraq was allowed to sell its oil to the world market, provided it used the United Nations as an intermediary, and provided the Iraqi government used the money from the sale of the oil for a limited number of approved items. But when the American army attacked Iraq, Saddam Hussein suspended the program. Turan Cham is chief captain at the Umatilla terminal. He says he understands the Iraqi position.
He doesn't believe that this oil monies will help their people. He thinks now the all big cities covered, in circle of coalition army. So there is some small towns, some places controlled by coalition army. If they sent the food, they are sending only these small towns. So they never sent the foods for Basra or Baghdad or medicines. So they are sending the small towns and using the media. Look, we are helping the Iraqi people. If Baghdad or Basra will be released, everything, then we will help them. Something like that. It is like propaganda war.
Iraqi oil officials at the terminal here refused to comment on tape for this story. But despite the war on their homeland, these Iraqis continue to show up for work every day. Kayan Turkulis is a Turkish oil tanker pilot working at the terminal. He says the oil officials have been far from happy about the American attacks on Baghdad.
They are always watching the TV, the news, because they have family there and they are working here, you know. And now, it's for me personally, it's very difficult for me to ask about their morality. I can say, I can understand from their face and looking, you know. I say only good morning and good day. That's all. And I don't want to talk, because what you can talk about them? How is your family? It's all right. How can you... difficult to understand, you know, because they are in war and...
Like many people around the world, Captain Turan Cham believes oil is the main reason for the war. He notes that while 50% of the money from Saudi oil goes to American and European companies, almost all of the money from the sale of Iraqi oil goes to the Iraqi state oil company. Cham compares the existing Mosul-Kirkuk oil pipeline with a new pipeline under construction for Azerbaijan oil, which will bring oil from the Caspian Sea to Turkey, carrying oil for British Petroleum.
This pipeline will carry oil of some companies' oil, not Azerbaijan government. Azerbaijan government has only 25%, something like that, inside of this pipe. The other 75% has big companies, BP and the other companies they have. Also the Turkish oil company, they have the 6%, something like that, oil in this pipe. There's a big difference. Iraqi pipeline only for oil belongs to Iraqi government. But this pipeline is as big companies come together, and the oil, maybe only 25-30% is Azerbaijan government.
The war is only about oil, says Captain Turan Cham, and almost everyone who works at the main port for Iraqi oil is inclined to agree. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz at the western end of the Mosul-Kirkuk oil pipeline in Umatilla, southwestern Turkey.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.